funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
To call Charlie Hamilton James adventurous is something of an understatement. He has photographed wildlife all over the world, bought a patch of Peruvian rainforest in hopes of preserving it, only to discover the previous owners were not quite off the land and were still growing coca on it. He survived a botfly infection and a case of the neglected tropical disease leishmaniasis, both picked up in his travels to remote places. The man has one camera he keeps on hand just for shooting lions. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Charlie Hamilton James is a wildlife photojournalist for National Geographic and a television host for the BBC. He's in town to speak about his work tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of the National Geographic Live speaker series. Charlie, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
How did you come to be so drawn to the Amazon?
Really, probably by mistake. Everyone says, oh, you must love it. You spend so much time there. You know, I spent a year in the Peruvian Amazon in my lifetime. And I find it a really hard place to be. It's not somewhere I love to be, but I do love the Amazon. So, and also, you know, in my job, you get typecast. And it's not a bad place to be typecast. So, yeah, I'm drawn to it for both professional and passionate reasons.
Typecast because people will say, Charlie will go anywhere. It doesn't matter how uncomfortable, how dangerous.
No, I think typecast, you know, you're the Amazon guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, and when you spend so much, you know, I spent a lot of time in one particular national park called Manu, you know, and if people in TV or in the magazine world want something from Manu, they Google it and guess whose face pops up. And so you end up being typecast like that.
Does the rainforest have a particular smell?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, not one. It's got many smells, but it's a very humid, heady, noisy place. You don't see very much. Everyone thinks there's so much life there. There is, and you know, there's more life than just about anywhere else. But you don't see anything because you have a green curtain in front of it. In front of it, you know, 30 yards away, there's a green curtain comes down. You can't see anything through the dense forest. And it's kind of like living in a kettle full of mosquitoes.
So how do you go about finding things that you want to photograph?
You know, as a wildlife photographer, there's kind of two ways of doing it. You can go out and take what nature gives you, or you could do what I do, which is go out and specifically know exactly A, what I want to photograph, and B, how I'm going to do it, and what the picture's going to look like. So I really know, before I leave, you know, wherever I'm staying, I know exactly what I want, how I'm going to get it. And you know, that's the only really way to work in the rainforest because you can't, as I said, you can't see anything. So for instance, I'll be photographing giant otters or adders, as you guys call them, which is huge. They're 6 feet long.
Right.
You know, and they're, you know, one of the most amazing animals in the Amazon. I'll spend a lot of time photographing them, but I'll always be after specific images of them, and I'll travel to huge distances to find them, and I'll invest a lot of time, money, and energy into getting those images.
So then you have a lot of waiting until nature does exactly what you've envisioned.
Yeah, I mean, people again say to me, "Oh, you must be very patient in your job," and I'm not. I'm very good at being really bored. You know, and since the invention of the iPhone, life is so much better. So I can, you know,
you get signal out in
no, money? But you know, I can watch stuff on it and play games and just because you do spend days and weeks just bored doing nothing. But the payoff, you know, when you finally get that shot, you kind of forget all of the boredom and the uncomfort, you know, and the mosquitoes and everything. It all kind of evaporates because you've got your shot.
You still have your first camera?
I do, yeah. It was a Nikon Mat my dad gave me when I was 14.
And what was your first inclination to do with it?
Well, you know, I grew up from the age of 7. I became obsessed with these little blue birds in England called kingfishers. You get them here. They're slightly different here. And I became really obsessed with these things. And I spent my childhood watching them. And, you know, when I was sort of 12, 13, I started getting a bit bored of that and thinking, well, how else can I channel this interest? And, you know, I decided I want to take pictures of them. And really that's what I've done ever since. You know, I'm 42 now. I'm still obsessed with kingfishers. So it kind of made my career as well. So, it, you know, that's kind of how these things work out. But it was an obsession, it was a passion, and it was a drive that has actually never left.
It's funny. In the next hour, we're talking to Anders Ericsson, who is the guy who was sort of misinterpreted, but came up with what was called the 10,000-hour rule. It's a little more complicated than that. But it seems that obsession is one of the most important things you can have to become a master of something. Did that all come from within, or were there people in your life who really channeled that for you?
I guess actually there weren't people that channeled it for me, to be fair. I was a disaster at school. And one of the reasons is, firstly, I hate authority. I hate being told what to do. And I also hate learning from other people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so sad to admit this, isn't it? But, I really want to be obsessional and learn stuff myself. I don't know where the drive to do that comes from. But, I look around at my fellow geographic photographers, and they're all the same. We are all obsessed with what mm-hmm. we do. And I guess you have to be. If you want to be good at what you do and get paid to do what you do and be successful, you've got to basically want to do nothing else. And it's a lovely state to be in because, you're never at work, really. Your whole life is indulging this obsession because it's, that's... Yeah, I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm thinking about work, but to me, I'm thinking about what I love thinking about. So it's
as an obsessive who bucks against authority and loves to learn things on his own. What's it like now raising kids? Are they like you?
My middle son is very similar to me. He's 12. He's learning Japanese. Has been for 3 years because he wants to learn Japanese. He's a very obsessional person. Very creative. Always drawing. Always making animations. But they're certainly not following in my footsteps. But it's very interesting when my kids were young, actually detaching myself from my job was really hard.
Yeah,
I mean, and a real strain on the family. Not because I was away a lot, because I wasn't. I was still there, but I was working, and I never stopped working. And that actually, you've got to, if you want to relax, you want to be a good dad. And you want to have a nice family, you've got to stop working occasionally, and that's the struggle. Now I'm a bit better at it because I've got older and wiser.
You're older and wiser, and your kids are probably a little more understanding of this feeding you.
Yeah, they just think I'm weird. we have a great relationship, actually. They're so funny, but yeah, they moan at me now because I go away now. I never used to go away when they were kids. And they don't like it. And I can't understand why. I said, why do you, your life just carries on. Why? But they don't like it when I go away. And I guess it kind of hurts sometimes. But I go away a lot now. So they're kind of used to it at the same time.
As someone who is in places that most people who don't do adventure travel would consider really dangerous and forbidding, are you... as afraid of anybody, but able to manage yourself in those environments? Do you think you have less fear than other people?
To turn that on its head completely, that question. The question you're asking is based on the assumption that remote places are dangerous, but they're not. And I get everyone asks me this all the time. You go to dangerous, but I don't. I go to amazing places, which I would say are probably a lot less dangerous than a lot of places here in the US or back in the UK. Actually, the Amazon's not a very dangerous place. It's got some diseases. It's got a few dangerous snakes. It doesn't have any large dangerous predators. It has, jaguars, pumas, but they're not really aggressive to people. So it doesn't, when you start looking at it and start looking at actually what the dangers are, there aren't actually that many. It's an exciting place, and the danger actually comes from the remoteness of it. If anything happens to you, you can't get out. That's when you're in trouble. So when we're doing trips, we're always working on, the best, most safe and efficient way to travel. I don't want to put myself in danger unnecessarily. Africa's a bit different. I spend a lot of time in Africa, and there's a human element in certain parts of Africa.
Unstable.
That make it more dangerous. But again, I'm always trying to limit that. And, sometimes I'll go to, I was doing a shoot in Kenya in December, and that was a dangerous place. So I limit the amount of time there because, I'm thinking, okay, I can push it to this point and then I'll get out so that I don't push the danger barrier too far.
When there's a language barrier, have you discovered ways that are sort of universal that you can communicate with people who don't speak the same language?
Yeah, you know, I spend so much time with people who can't speak my language, and for, I don't know how we do it, but we always end up laughing and having fun. And you know, what amazes me actually is that no matter where you go in the world, we're all far more similar than we think. You know, as a photographer, I go to these remote parts of the Amazon to find people to photograph, and I end up thinking, you know, and you go there to see the difference in people.
Right.
You know, I come away thinking, well, we're all the same, we're just dressed differently. You know, because we all laugh at the same things, and we all, you know, we just fit in as human beings and get along very well, and it kind of works. But generally, I'll have a, you know, if I'm in a place where I can't speak the language, I will have someone who can. So, you know, if I'm with a film crew, I'll have a translator, and if I'm with a Geographic, I'll have an assistant who can, you know, mainly Spanish, because my Spanish is so awful. It's embarrassing. I mean, I'm a year in Peru and I can't speak Spanish. Unless it's lazy.
We're speaking this hour with Charlie Hamilton James. He's a wildlife photojournalist and television host for the BBC. He's in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. Back in 2 minutes with Charlie Hamilton James.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program, where students can customize their degree, like Lonnie Gentry, pursuing healthcare leadership and ethics. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with wildlife photojournalist Charlie Hamilton James. He has worked for National Geographic. He's also a television host for the BBC. He's in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of the National Geographic Live Speaker Series. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You say that vultures are full of charisma. How is that possible?
Okay, so I love vultures. I really love vultures. In fact, I saw one from when I was waiting to come in here just now, flying between the skies.
Right in the city, yeah.
Yeah. But I have a real thing for African vultures, which are much bigger, and they're more aggressive, and they're kind of a bit more grotesque.
They don't sound charismatic, given that.
No, and they don't. And you know, they don't look it, and they don't behave it. Uh-huh. But they're kind of, they're a bit like hyenas in the sense that they're an anti-hero.
Yeah.
And anti-heroes have charisma, and I like championing the anti-heroes. So you know, I once made a film on hyenas, and then I made a film for the BBC on vultures, and then I shot an article for Geographic on vultures. And when you spend that much time looking and studying and working with a subject, you can't really help but fall in love with it. So now when I go to Africa, and I go there a lot, I'm just looking at vultures. Everyone else is looking at lions. I'm like, come over here, look at the vultures. They're much better.
I know that you will hire sometimes an expert wildlife driver, and I didn't even know this was a thing until I read what you'd written about that. What is an expert wildlife driver able to do that regular people who get behind the wheel wouldn't?
Actually, there's kind of two things. First, as a wildlife cameraman, what you normally have, certainly in Africa if you're driving, is you'll have an expert wildlife driver who drives and specializes in getting photographers and filmmakers into exactly the right place at the right time. So for instance, if you have a cheetah and you know it's going to hunt a Thompson's gazelle, well, you've got to anticipate and be in the right place. You don't want to disturb it. You don't want to ruin the hunt. But you've got to know roughly where the hunt's going to end and be in place before the Thompson's gazelle's even seen the cheetah. And that's a real skill. So well, I work with people like that a lot. But the main person I work with, a guy called Simon Thompson, who lives in Kenya, he is actually one of the world's leading experts in birds of prey. He's one of the world experts on vultures. But he also happens to drive me around Kenya because him and I work together really well. And, you know, I can sit with a driver or I can sit with an expert who can drive. And that's what I do.
Is there a downside to getting along really well with the people that are with you in the field because you can be distracted by conversation?
No, I don't think so. I think certainly when we're working on stories for the Geographic, we're constantly talking about the story. It's pretty much all we're talking about for the entire time. And Simon, for instance, who I work most with, he's a bit like my son. He's so obsessed with birds of prey and vultures that I actually have to tell him to shut up sometimes because my brain can't take any more of it. But no, I think it's actually really important you get on well with the people you're with. Because it makes you do your job better. And you can, sometimes moments are tense. Sometimes you have to do things you don't both agree with. But if you've got a good rapport, you're not going to fall out over it. And that's the key thing, especially when you're spending 3 weeks, 4 weeks, even 6 weeks with one person. You know, you don't want to be in a situation where you've fallen out with them.
How much are you thinking about beauty in your compositions when you are showing an animal that most people sort of think of as revolting, even if they haven't paid close attention to what those animals can do?
So, certainly when I present a story and a set of images, I have an idea of exactly what I want those images to do, and it's all based on emotion. So I'm basing my images. What I want to do is confirm to the viewer, let's take the vultures. I want to confirm to the viewer, the reader, exactly what they already think, which are vultures are bloody and disgusting. You know, they're covered in blood and it's just grotesque. So one of my key images for that is a photo of a vulture's bloody head with a blood drop dripping off its beak. Mm-hmm. You know, it confirms everything you think about vultures. And then I want to start turning that on its head and, you know, making people reassess what they think. So the next image I'll often show is one of a vulture just so covered in flies with, you know, a half-winking eye. And you look at this picture and you feel sorry for it. Now, the reason is you can empathize with it. It looks uncomfortable and you feel sorry for it. And that's an emotional response. So immediately I start getting you connected to the vulture emotionally. And the more I can do that, the more I can make you care about the vulture. And I want people to care about the vulture. And then, you know, often I'll, you know, when I show people pictures, for instance, then I'll take them and I'll immerse them in the world of the vulture. So, you know, I have a photo I took with a camera inside a dead zebra. And they're all the vultures fighting. It's so disgusting, but it's a very dynamic and very interesting photo because you think, wow, that's what it's like down on their level.
How do you clean the camera after you stuck it inside a zebra carcass?
I can't imagine what that camera looked like when we pulled it out. And you know what? I'd actually been lent it by a camera company, and they'd lent me this brand new, $1,000 camera. And I took a photograph of it after I pulled it out, and it had been really kicked around by the vultures inside this carcass. And I put this picture of this camera on Instagram. I didn't know they followed me on Instagram. Anyway, they didn't ask for it back.
Well, that's one good way to acquire new gear, I guess. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ryan on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi.
Hi, Ryan.
Hi. So I was wondering, in your experiences, what kind of lessons can more modern societies learn from these indigenous peoples and the greater animal kingdom that you've worked with?
I think, well, firstly, indigenous communities are generally in and around some of the world's most important protected areas. Certainly in the Amazon, that's the case. You know, and also in Africa and the Masai Mara and places like that. And they are the people that are key to protecting those protected areas, you know, to keeping them in good condition. And what the West is slowly realizing, and I think conservation is realizing, and has been really for the last few years, is that, you know, we have to work with these people to protect their lands. And those lands and those protected areas are globally important. Doesn't matter where we live in the world. The Amazon should be as important to us here as it is for people in South America. So we need to, I guess the lesson we need to learn is that we ignore those people at our own peril. And as well as indigenous people, we must not forget the people that also live in the areas where indigenous people live, who aren't indigenous but are poor. Now, indigenous people might be, many of them I work with might be materially poor, but they're not. I wouldn't consider them people poor and living in poverty. They're not. They lead incredibly rich, fulfilling, and fantastic lives. But also, you do get areas where there are very poor people living in poverty who aren't indigenous, and I guess who haven't culturally adapted to living where they live. But they are equally important. They're still human beings. They still have needs, and they still need to survive. And we as a human race need to protect those people, because they are also protecting our protected areas.
When you bought your piece of Peruvian rainforest, you came to a much more nuanced understanding of the reality for people on the ground. You still wanted to protect the land, but you understood that it was more complicated than that.
Yeah, you know, I went out there as a wildlife photographer. I bought this land over the phone. I'd never seen it. I was asked to buy it by the head of the national park because it was the bit of land the illegal loggers were using to access the national park. And I went out there, you know, really with no interest in people and conservation. I was interested in conservation. I'd never really bothered to make the connection. And the key thing I learned from that experience of going there, and I was there for nearly a year. I spent a long time on the ground. I did a trip right across the Amazon to really look at the Amazon as it is, not how we want it to be, as it is. And the thing I got from that was that people in poverty, mainly because they were the people I lived and worked with, are valuable members of society. They love the rainforest. They respect the rainforest, even though they're cutting it down. And, you know, when you add a human and a social element to an environmental problem, it becomes so much more complicated. It's not black and white and murky. And as a result, I didn't really come away with any answers. I just got more and more and more and more confused the more I knew.
Yeah. I've thought about this, that, you know, people in indigenous cultures could, I mean, I'm not encouraging this, but they could be cutting down parts of the rainforest if there weren't, you know, 7 billion of us on the planet, some of whom want, you know, coffee tables made out of, you know, rare woods. It's almost like the developed world wants to take what it wants and then wants to limit the ability of people who actually live in those places to try to survive from them.
Yeah, I mean, if you take the Amazon, for example, if you look at the four sort of key environmental problems in the Amazon, the cocaine, you know, everyone hears about cocaine, the trafficking and how dangerous and everything. You know, to grow cocaine, you cut down rainforest and you grow cocaine. So you've got cocaine, you've got gold. Gold is horrendously polluting to the Amazon. It's mined, that they mine for dust, not nuggets. Mm. So they cut down huge areas of rainforest. They pollute it with mercury and a whole raft of other chemicals. It's a very destructive thing, you know. They say it takes 20 tons of toxic waste to make a wedding ring, you know.
Wow.
So you got cocaine, gold, you got Brazilian beef. Beef is just about as destructive to the Amazon as anything possibly could be. Agriculture is responsible for around 90% of deforestation in the Amazon. So it's a major, major problem. And then you got the extraction of tropical hardwoods like mahogany. We've all heard of mahogany. So those four products are all luxury items, you know, gold, cocaine, mahogany, Brazilian beef. Hmm. You know, they are luxury items. Who are the end users? We are. You know, 90% or something, 95% of Peru's mahogany that's exported is illegal. The US is the biggest importer in the world. The UK is the second biggest importer in the world. You know, we are buying these products. We're also, you know, producing all the carbon. Yeah. So we moan at the people in the Amazon for cutting it down. But we need the Amazon because the Amazon sucks up carbon. It releases oxygen. And it's mainly our carbon. So, and then we shout and moan at poor people and say, oi, protect it. But of course they can't, because to them it's all they've got to survive. It's their resource. So there's a huge conflict here. And protecting it, it really needs to start sort of, in order to protect it, we need to look at new ways of tackling it and going about it. Because what we're doing now really isn't working.
We're speaking with writer and photojournalist Charlie Hamilton James. He's in town to speak at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science tonight as part of National Geographic Live. That's a speaker series. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can customize your master's degree to distinguish yourself in the workplace. You can apply now for summer. Deadline is May 1st. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with National Geographic wildlife photojournalist and BBC television host and photojournalist Charlie Hamilton James. He'll speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live. It's a speaker series. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Just to come back for a minute to vultures, why are they in so much trouble?
Okay, so let's take India to start with. In India, people used to use a drug called diclofenac, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, on cattle. And when cattle were ill, they'd be given this drug. And it turned out that it was lethal to vultures. And some populations in India over 10, 15 years declined by 99%.
Hmm. So the meat was essentially poisoned unintentionally.
For them, yeah. Actually, for other animals, no. So India went through this just catastrophic vulture decline where it basically lost almost all of its vultures, which actually led to a rise in feral dogs because, you know, those vultures were eating around 20 million tons of rotting meat a year.
Wow.
So when you remove the key feeder of that amount of meat and you replace it with something else, it was dogs. And actually they got a big spike in human cases of rabies as a result. So that was a massive disaster. But then it started happening in Africa, and actually for very different reasons. And it's still happening, and it's getting worse. And so the African vulture population is now in absolute catastrophic decline, making the vultures at the moment the fastest declining birds in history, the fastest declining family of your group of species in the world at the moment. So when I present vultures to people, everyone has the same response about how grotesque they are. But when actually you start looking and explaining to people about the decline and the fact that, the plains of Africa are soon going to be empty of vultures, you start realizing how important they are. Vultures eat more meat on the plains of Africa than all the other predators and scavengers combined. So what happens when you take them out of the equation? Well, the whole ecosystem's going to do something. No one quite knows what yet, but it's coming.
So are there different kinds of challenges when you are trying to educate people, photograph, shoot on film or video, an animal that is, instantly charismatic, like an otter or an ulta, as you would say?
Yeah, as a photographer, I'll answer this question as a photographer. So... And I'm gonna do a story for Geographic on sea otters this time. Okay? Right, so I'm already thinking. I know I haven't even started shooting. I only saw my first sea otter last week when I took the family to Monterey. Okay, so I'm already thinking, right, how can I present these animals to the general public? Every time anyone puts a photo of a baby sea otter on on social media, hundreds of millions of people look at it worldwide. Because
so it's like a cheap thing for you to do. Right, right.
Yeah. But for me, I want to what I do is I look at every photo that's ever been taken of these things, whatever it is. And then I think, okay, everyone's done that. What can I do that's different? How can I tackle this and approach this in a way that no one has ever done before? And, I can do that because I have the time and the resources to do it, which allows me to do, to come up with images that perhaps people haven't got before. For instance, we've just done a very big story for the National Geographic on the Yellowstone ecosystem. I was there for a year. I was only working for, I wasn't working full time for a year, but I was there taking photos for a year. And, that gave me a chance to get some photos in Yellowstone and Grand Teton, which has got to be one of the most, photographed areas of the world.
Yeah.
But photos that really stood out. And the reason they stood out is because we put time into them. I have a photo of a bear in front of the Teton Mountains and all these ravens flying around that was actually a camera trap. So, the you leave the camera out and it has this infrared sensor on and it takes pictures. But I got to leave that out for 5 months. It took a quarter of a million photos of ravens, this camera, before the bear ran in. So we get the chance to do that. And as a result, we get to show people a different way of looking at the world and at animals, particularly for me.
How often do you use artificial light?
So if I'm camera trapping, for instance, where, as I just said, where you put these remote cameras out, it depends where I am. If I'm in the rainforest, there's hardly any light down there because the tree cover's so heavy. So I'll use flash guns. I'll use up to 3 to 5 flash guns to take a picture. So quite a lot, actually. And actually, one of the certainly as a wildlife photographer, one of the big differences between, I think, the Geographic and lots of other people is that we do use a lot of light. So we and using light to light a wild animal, especially if you don't want to disturb it, is actually very difficult. But, you know, that's kind of what we do.
Do you pack your gear in exactly the same way every time you go somewhere?
No. And I also, you know, I've spent 20 years as a wildlife cameraman. I hate traveling with kit now.
Really?
Yeah, I just want like one bag. Or I just so minimal what I can carry now. Because I don't want, you know, I feel weighted by it. And every time you get to a hotel, you know, you can get 30 Pelly cases out and stick them in the room. You know, I don't want that anymore. Like a couple of bags. But it varies. Yeah, every shoot is different. When I do the sea otter shoot, I will have a lot of kit. I mean, there will be the whole back of the car and roof of the car will be full of boxes. But, you know, I'm going to Africa next week. I'll take 3 bags with me probably.
From speaking with you, it sounds like I'm sure there are many people who envy your job. On the one hand, maybe they think it's worse than it is. And on the other hand, they probably think it's better than it is. I know that you love it. But what do you think people misunderstand about what you do for a living?
I think they misunderstand the amount of time and obsession and effort we put into getting those pictures. And the level at which the Geographic works at. You know, I work to a picture editor. In fact, I have 2 who really, really make me work hard. Especially with my light, actually, because it's a big obsession at National Geographic. So it's not just a case of taking a few good pictures and turning them in. It's taking some really good pictures and turning a story in. And story is the thing that, you know, a lot of people are very good photographers, but they're not great storytellers. And to do my job, you know, at the standard that Geographic would like, I've got to be a good photographer and I've got to be a good storyteller. And I think that's what most people, I guess, don't get.
You're also a writer, not only nonfiction, but you've written fiction.
I wrote, oh God, it's so embarrassing. I wrote a spoof novel about the Matrix called The Matrix. And it was about a guy, the hero, couldn't say his R's properly and it got him in a whole world of trouble. And you know, it was this absurd novel. It was one of those tiny little Christmas books you could buy many years ago. And it was at the publisher phoned me up and asked me to write. Anyway, I wrote it. Because it was almost a bestseller. I did very well out of it. Terrible book.
How is the experience different for you if you are in the field and you're functioning essentially as talent as opposed to being behind either a still camera or a moving camera?
Well, firstly, I don't like being talent. At first, I thought I would. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's good for the ego. But I very soon realized actually it's very boring. You know, you're just doing a lot of sitting around. And
because someone else is in charge?
Yeah, and I don't mind someone being in charge. What I mind is just there's all the waiting around and then being filmed. I just find the whole process boring. I like the bits either side of it when you're in the country and you're traveling and all of that stuff. Whereas if I'm behind the camera, I'm doing what I'm really obsessional about. And so I'm much happier doing that.
But is a video shoot different from a still shoot? I mean, in the ways that you wait and in the ways that you're setting up and experimenting.
Yeah, I mean, a still shoot's it's actually much simpler. You know, TV is a quite a complicated art form to get right and to get good. And there's usually more people. You know, I can go off and take photos on my own. Whereas in TV, there's a whole host of stuff that needs doing and people and equipment that needs setting up. So it's a much lonelier business being a photographer, but I'm much happier with.
If you weren't typecast, is there a part of the world, a subject that you would like to shoot, maybe before you show it to anybody and decide whether this is something that you're really good at?
Yeah, you know, I as a subject, I'd like to try actually be a portrait photographer. And
really?
Yeah, because I've never tried it. Mm-hmm. I love trying new things. You know, I'd never photographed people till about 3 years ago. I decided I want to photograph people. But, you know, when I decided to go photograph people, I'm then put against the top, you know, photojournalists in the world who all do it for a living. So, you know, within 3 years, I got to get to that level. So as a subject, yeah, I'd like to try and do that as a place. I'd like to, Antarctica's just, oh, I've never been. But, you know, that's got to be the place to go to me.
What draws your attention when you look at a portrait that someone else has done?
The tiny nuances of how you know, for the light and the expression and the emotion and the things that that photographer has mastered in order to get. Because, you know, you can sit someone there for a passport photo, and then you can get a photographer who can do it really well. And how do they do it? How those tiny, you know, how does the light work on the nose and the eyes and, you know, the position of the hands and the expression? And I look at them and I, you know, it's a very finely nuanced art form that I have no idea about.
Perfect, John, for an obsessive. Charlie Hamilton James is a photojournalist for National Geographic and for the BBC. He's in town to speak tonight at the Perot Museum of Nature and Science as part of National Geographic Live Speaker Series. Charlie, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for making this time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Thanks.